This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shemuel Aleph, chapter 17. This lengthy chapter describes the famous confrontation between David and Goliath, who we know as Goliath in English. The armies of Israel and the Philistim are faced one towards another on the battlefield, but no actual combat is underway. Each day, a very tall, strong, mighty, heavily armored Philistine stands between the two camps and hurls belittling and denigrating insults at the Jews. He challenges the Jewish army to send any warrior who can fight him in hand-to-hand combat, and he says that the winner of this match will be able to claim the entire other side as slaves. In other words, if the Jews are able to send even one person to defeat Goliath, then the Jews can consider themselves the victors over the Pelishtim, and vice versa. If Goliath should defeat the person they send to fight him, then the Pelishtim will declare victory. The Israelites here are petrified. The Jews are petrified by the menacing spectacle of Goliath, and for 40 days they remain silent and do not offer any response to his taunts. David is dispatched by his father Yishai to bring provisions to his three older brothers, all of whom are members of the army of King Shaul. He brings a sort of care package, gifts, not only to them but to their supervising officer, and inquires after their welfare. While he's there, in order to go, he has to leave his sheep with the with someone who is going to substitute for him and supervising them, and he runs off to the battlefield to fulfill the mitzvah of listening to his father's instructions. Now, while visiting the camp, he has the opportunity to hear the vile pronouncements of the intimidating Goliath. He becomes aware of the fact that the king has offered an ample reward, not only to marry the king's daughter, but to become rich and to be free of taxes for his family for his entire life. To anyone who can rise up to the challenge of the Philistine. In other words, the stakes are high. The reward is great. David asks several individuals for the details of what Shaul has offered, and he expresses outrage at the desecration of God's name that he sees being perpetrated by this uncircumcised Philistine. He seems to be especially vocal, so that the stir he creates will be brought to the king's attention. His eldest brother rebukes him for his troublemaking, but David ignores his sharp words and continues on. Eventually, King Shaul hears of David's statements and summons him to a private audience. David informs the king that the Jews have nothing to fear, Hashem will battle for them, and that he's personally willing to go out and fight the Philistine. Now, King Shaul is hesitant to allow David, a young kid who has no military experience, fight against someone much older who's been a fighting man for his entire life. In other words, since his youth, he's been trained in military tactic and on the battlefield, and David knows nothing of this. David recounts a story to Shaul of some of the mighty deeds he performed as a shepherd. He fought off a bear, he fought off a lion. He said, this Philistine is no stronger, no more mighty, no more intimidating than one of those animals. Just as Hashem helped me to defeat them, he'll help me to defeat this Philistine. So Shaul, impressed with the faith that David has in Hashem, agrees to allow him to go out and face the Pelishti. David tries to put on the armor of Shaul, but it's too heavy and uncomfortable for him, so instead he takes his slingshot and five smooth rocks to go and confront him. When Goliath sees some wimpy-looking kid that the Jews have sent to fight him, he feels insulted, and he's amused and insulted all at once. He insults David and the people of Israel again, cursing them and promising to pulverize his opponent. David, not prepared to back down, talks smack right back to Goliath. He says that he may have better armor and weaponry on his side, but David has Hashem, who's going to empower him to prevail over the Pelishtim. Goliath is incensed, and he charges at David. David, rather than running in the opposite direction, runs towards Goliath. And as he runs, he reaches into his pouch, takes out stones, and he slings a stone right at the forehead of Goliath. It sinks into Goliath's head. He falls over and collapses. David approaches Goliath, takes out the sword of the giant himself, and decapitates him. The Jews, their sense of morale restored by this event, chase after and deliver a powerful blow to the Pelishtim. Shaul inquires to find out who is this kid who pulled this off. What's his family's name? Where'd he come from? He came out of nowhere. He asks Avner, his general, and Avner does not know. David explains that he is the son of Yishai from Bethlehem. So we have a very interesting story here, obviously on many levels. Now, this chapter is particularly rich in detail and ideas, and in theory, we could devote many, many pages of discussion to it. But for the sake of brevity, we're going to have a brief summary and brief written summaries. So we want to stay to just a couple of key points. Now, there's one thematic highlight I'd like to share, which is that the fact that Goliath is capable of single-handedly terrorizing the Israelite camp is kind of a sad commentary on the bravery of the Jewish army. They're not able to stand up against one big, strong guy. But there's a symbolic element in the description of his activities that we shouldn't miss. He comes morning and evening over a period of 40 days. Now, the 40 days is most certainly reminiscent of, supposed to evoke memory of the 40 days that Moshe Rabbeinu spent on Mount Sinai receiving the Torah. Usually 40 days, that's the symbolic meaning in the Tanakh. But our sages also comment that the morning and evening of hurling insults means that he caused them to forget to say the Shema, which normally we would recite morning and evening. Now, what is this Midrash trying to get at? I believe that they're trying to point to a deeper level of theme in this story that's critical for understanding it properly. When the soldiers tell David about their Philistine tormentor, they speak in material terms. They talk about the physical intimidation. They talk about the fear. They talk about how strong he is, how mighty he is. They talk about the material reward for defeating him, marrying the king's daughter, becoming rich, being free of taxes, and so on. But when David speaks about it, you'll notice that each time David addresses the situation, he focuses on the desecration of God's name that's involved here. He focuses on the fact that Goliath is denigrating the army of the living God. And he also focuses on the fact that the one who's going to ensure that he wins and that is going to ensure that Goliath is not successful is Hashem. So the period of 40 days and the failure to recite the Shema, in a way, are reflecting the shift in attention away from Torah, away from Hashem. They're not saying the Shema. They're not thinking about the Torah. What's large in their mind? What's looming large in their mind? What are they captivated by? It's not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not Hashem's kingship, but it is the power and the might of this Philistine. The text is emphasizing, directly and indirectly, as the Midrash brings out, that Goliath is so large in their minds because Hashem has become so small and insignificant in their minds. And as is always the case in Tanakh, the enemy achieves the upper hand against the Jews when the Jews neglect their covenantal responsibilities to Hashem and start pursuing political power and material goods for their own sake. Unlike the beginning of his career, when King Shaul recognized this principle and it was very important to him to make sure that the Jews saw that their victory came from Hashem, and very important that he bring korbanot to Hashem, and very important that they stay on the right track, although he made mistakes. We know he made mistakes. But essentially, he had this perspective in mind. So here we can see that ultimately he failed in his mission. We don't see any sign of crying out to God here. We don't see any sign of teshuvah here. We don't see any sign of even a korban here, any sacrifice. He is paralyzed by the spectacle of Goliath and doesn't make any move. David, on the other hand, who's devoted to God, easily sees past the veneer of the Philistine and of the Pelishtim in general and perceives an animal like a lion or bear who can be outsmarted and vanquished. He capitalizes on this knowledge, taunting Goliath so that the giant loses his temper and charges at him full speed ahead. This allows David, who trusts in Hashem's providence and in the power of wisdom, to conquer unbridled physical force, to calmly and confidently put an end to an intractable conflict. The only solution to the problem was to extricate himself from the limiting effect of the psychological tactics employed by the Pelishtim. That feeling that human power and the imposing figure of Goliath was everything and all that there was, and to take refuge instead in God-given knowledge as the source of victory. David does this, and he demonstrates that he was more than qualified to be a true leader in Israel, a leader who sees his victory, his success, as contingent on his knowledge and his service of Hashem. As I mentioned in comments in the previous chapter, one of the biggest interpretive challenges of these chapters is the chronology. There's a big chronological problem, because in this chapter, it seems as if Shaul has never met David before. He's asking all kinds of questions about the identity of David. Whereas in the previous chapter, we saw that he was the court musician of Shaul, and he had become a regular attendant and even an assistant to King Shaul. So Rashi and most of the traditional commentaries assume that the chapters are written in order, and they say that it's not that Shaul didn't know David here when the episode with Goliath took place. It's that Shaul didn't know that David had any military background, and he started questioning, where did he learn to be so courageous? Where did he learn to fight like this? Where did he learn such military skill? So that was what he was investigating and trying to find out. An alternative approach is brought in the name of Shmuel ben Chofni Gaon and has been adopted by some contemporary scholars. It does have its persuasive elements here. According to this view, the chapter sequence is out of order. In reality, at the time David volunteered to confront Goliath, he was completely unknown to Shaul. This was their first encounter. Chapter 16, which describes David's employment as court musician, happened after the incident with Goliath, which might explain why in chapter 16 he's referred to as a mighty warrior and somebody who God is with him and so on and so forth. Before defeating the Pelishti, it doesn't seem like he had any reputation at all. So the fact that he had such a reputation seems to suggest that it was after the fight against Goliath. Now, Shaul's depression and melancholy were likely caused by his repeated frustration on the battlefield against the Pelishtim, and maybe even his feeling of inadequacy was exacerbated by the unlikely slaying of the invincible Goliath by a mere kid. So this also might explain why when Shmuel visits Yishai's home, there's an assumption that we are already familiar with his sons and who's the oldest and who's the youngest and so on. These facts are only introduced to us explicitly in chapter 17, yet they're kind of assumed in chapter 16. There are also a number of hints in the text and in Midrashic works that seem to support the theory that the fight against Goliath preceded the selection of David as king and his appointment as harp player for Shaul. Of course, this approach is also not without its difficulties, because if David had already defeated Goliath, why was he not even considered by his family as a possible candidate for kingship when Shmuel came? And why is he sent home after the incident with Goliath, only to be returned to the palace for his musical services later on? In this chapter, in chapter 17, it seems that he was retained by Shaul after this event as part of his military team, and that he wasn't sent home and brought back later. Now, we may never know the precise chronology here. It is a mystery. But I'd like to emphasize that regardless of the chronological sequence, the chapters are organized thematically. And that's what's important to us as students of the Devar Hashem, students of Nevuah, students of prophecy. We want to understand the prophetic message. The historical details are not that critical. The point of the chapter 16, is to chart the downfall and marginalization of Shaul, which involves his descent into melancholy, his depression, and the identification of David as his eventual successor. In other words, that's the end of the story of Shaul, if you will. In the course of the description of Shaul's downfall, we read of David's being hired as musician to assuage his pain. Because regardless of when it occurred, it's important to understand, because it's going to play a role in future instances of Shaul's continuous struggle with depression and loss of control. Not so much because it gives us insight into David. Chapter 17, by contrast, is primarily concerned with the rise of David as the next monarch. He is therefore introduced to us again, and the beginning of his career as leader and teacher is presented in dramatic detail. So it's as if we had ever met him before, because in the context of leader and teacher, in the context of future king, we have never met him. We've only seen him in the context of the one who's involved in the slow conclusion of Shaul's career, rather than in the beginning of his own career. So if we look at the chapters thematically, we look at the first, at chapter 16, as the closing out of Shaul, and we look at the chapter 17 as the opening up of David. It doesn't matter as much which of these incidents happened first, what order, maybe if there was overlap. It's not that significant. What's significant is the themes here, the conclusion of Shaul's kingship and now the beginning of David's meteoric rise to leadership.